to another episode of the Dear Fathers Podcast. I'm your host, Jesse Alex, also the co-founder of Dear Fathers, which is the premier media platform dedicated to telling stories of Black fatherhood while providing resources for Black men. I'm excited today, man. This guy played a huge role in music in the era when, you know, I was growing up, graduated high school, things of that nature. So this will forever be special to me. And he's still doing amazing things to this day. You know, so I want to welcome rapper known for songs like It's Going Down, I Know You See It, also a syndicated radio host and amazing father, of course, Young Jock. Welcome to the Dear Fathers Podcast, man. How you doing today?
I'm good, brother. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, no problem, man. You know, I'm excited. You know, this platform is for brothers like yourself, man, like, you know, to come on and talk about who you are as a Black man and Black father. So, you know, we're just getting straight into it, man. Take us back to your upbringing, man. Who were you before, you know, the fame? Who was Young Jock before the fame? And specifically, like, you know, describe, you know, your parents and, like, how they raised you.
You know, here's an interesting thing, man. I didn't know my father until about five, my biological father. And that was just, you know, the arrangements he and my mother had. So it wasn't a, you know, she just was like, look, you don't have to be in this life. It was a situation at the moment. So he was married. She was like, you know, I'm gonna protect the situation the best I can. She married shortly after to another gentleman by the name of Stanley. My father's name is Stanley as well. So that was this. It's very interesting dynamic because my mother was a working woman. She worked on the railroad. And my stepfather, her husband, he worked for a company, United Waste, right? And it was oftentimes, man, he would come home and bring me gifts that came out of the trash pile. Now, one could frown upon that, you know what I'm saying, like that. But the most important aspect of that is it wasn't just toys. He would bring me a microscope. He would bring me a chemistry set. Because some of these jobs that he had to do, some odd reason, they was throwing bad or damaged inventory away, I guess. And the insurance would pay for it, so they were just chunking it in the trash. And so I had things like the letter people, pickle people. These were all, you're talking, man, 37 years ago, 38 years ago, because I'm 44 now, so around 6 or 7 years old, yeah. And I just remember, like, always getting the gifts that I didn't want, you know, and that was like gifts that were good for me. They were essential in my, you know, developmental stages in life, that early development stage. And so when other kids was out playing Nintendos, doing all that, I had things that captured my attention from a different angle, you know. And my mom was very hard on me. She didn't play the radio. But because I was a tagged child, talented and gifted, you know, it was oftentimes I was ahead of myself. So I could have, that was a certain aptitude that was present, right? But it was accompanied by an offset of things that I didn't have yet, like a certain level of discipline, you know, a certain part of my character had not formed yet, you know what I'm saying? So I was one of those kids. I was really smart, but I was really mischievous at the same time. So by the time I met my dad, bro, it was like, whoa, this I look just like this person. It's like, oh, snap. And it was just a, I don't know, I guess it's like you walk into a tribe and you look around and realize I belong to this tribe. And then you start peeping the nature of this tribe. You start realizing, yo, this is a very smart tribe. This tribe has a certain level of instinct of how to survive, a certain will to survive. So I started, it started changing who I was as a child, and I started to develop more of an understanding of a disciplined nature, a different rearing, different upbringing. So, I never really told nobody this story ever. As long as I've been doing interviews in my entire career, I've never ever spoke of that to, in that capacity, in describing my childhood early on.
No, that's what's up, man. I love to hear that, and I appreciate you sharing that with us here today. I'm interested though, you said your mom remarried, you didn't meet your dad till you were five. When you did meet your dad and you had that stepfather, what was that dynamic like? Were they both playing, father figures in your life, and
Oh,
just
yeah.
kind of what was that dynamic and having then two father figures in your life? Was there any battles or struggles on what that looked like, or was it just a
You
smooth?
know, to be honest with you, the beginning stages of it wasn't any problems because my stepfather, he had a certain level of intellect as well. Rest his soul. He had a certain level of discipline too. But also, I was not his biological child. And in a lot of cases, that really doesn't mean a lot. But it's the moment you realize, oh, I do have a father that is my father. So he's not my real father. So it was moments where I'd be like, if I felt like he was being mean, of course, now I'm thinking, man, is my real father going to be like this too? But I think I was able to understand that it's good. I got two heroes on my side and a mother, which is a hero too. So, but then my father, check this out. My father also had a long-term girlfriend at that moment, at that time. And I remember them getting engaged and I remember them being married, so I had essentially two mothers and two fathers. So I think for me, I think it helped a lot with my balance. You know what I'm saying? Because I if you think about kids who have a strong grandmother, or not, it's not even strong, they have a grandmother and a grandfather active in their life, a mother and a father active in their life. Those, and I don't have the statistics in front of me, but I've looked at this before. Those people end up being very balanced and well-rounded citizens in their later years because they're getting an upbringing that comes with so many dynamics. You know what I'm saying? Because, in a unit, the mother and the father could play good cop, bad cop. So, on my dad's house, my dad was the bad cop, my stepmother was the good cop. In my household, my mom and dad, it felt like they was both bad cop. And I'm not saying when I use the word bad, I don't mean like they were bad parents. It's just a stern role. You know what I'm saying? You got the stern one. Hey, no, sit down. Excuse me. What did you say? Finta, finna, finsta. That's not a word. Getting ready to, I'm about to, I am. My mom was like that. My stepfather was like that. So I think that, like, for me, being able to have these different people I could talk to, knowing I had certain people in my corner, it made me feel a lot more loved. It made me feel a lot more complete.
No, that's dope, man. And even to, from my POV, I started this platform because I grew up without my dad. I recently just reconnected with my father for the first time in maybe 21 years, and I'm 35 years old. So
Wow.
I have that viewpoint that you had when you were a child, where you're going into the tribe and you're looking around, where it's like, oh, like I'm from part of this too. I'm not getting that till 35 years old. So being that you got that when you was a kid, I'm sure that helped, like you said, just create that balance for you. So I love to hear stories like that, man. So, I appreciate you for sharing. And I want to just kind of,
Doing your dad reconnected too.
what'd you say?
I said, I'm glad you and your dad reconnected.
I appreciate that, man. And it's, it's going pretty decent, man. It's a interesting situation, I'll say the least. But I had to get over my hurdles in terms of just wanting to or be willing to make that reconnection with him and his side of the family, just because I spent so much time without him for a while. I was just like, man, F him, man. Like I don't need that. But again, starting this platform was based on me growing up without my father. So, hearing you say that, man, really just kind of meant something to me, because that's kind of how I feel now. So I appreciate you for sharing. And I'm interested to know, like, having two moms and two dads, when you wanted to start like rapping or being in entertainment, like how did they, what were they, kind of saying towards that? Because that's not a traditional thing, right? Like, were they all for it, or did you kind of have to prove yourself? You always, like you said, were a talented kid, but how did they take you wanting to be in entertainment?
So here's the thing. I was always melodramatic, always silly, funny, this lovable kid, right? And you could tell me to do something, and I could very well execute a task. So they understood I had some behavioral curves and challenges, not necessarily learning curves and learning challenges. But you still that still can fall under learning curves, because even learning proper behavior is a requirement, right? So it's so interesting, because it was times when I wanted to do plays. Yes, before they come to see me do a play, you go. My dad would show up with his wife. My mom would be there, my grandparents would be there, So I had this interesting challenge ahead of me, and I didn't realize it, because it was moments when I'm with my mom, because once her and my stepfather separated, she was a single mother. My mom didn't have a lot of guys in and out. My mom never really exposed me to any type of promiscuous behavior, so I never knew my mom to date, really, for real. And maybe that's why she was so, don't want to use the word mean, just stern. Because she was always able to constantly focus on what was going on with her, you know what I'm saying? Opposed to, being a little swept off her feet here and there, and going out on dates and being loved on properly by a man. And if that was going on, I never shared that space with her, because I didn't see it. Meaning, like, I never saw her be properly courted. I never saw a man really open the door for my mother and make sure she was good. I never seen a man stop what he was doing and make sure my mother got that teddy bear that she wanted at the fair. I didn't see any of that. But my mom stressed that that's the type of man that I had to be. And that was the reason why she was single, because she wasn't going to deal with nobody who wouldn't treat her properly. You know what I'm saying? So my mom saw me being the little kid that was trying to rap and do all that. My dad didn't see it as much, because when I was with my dad, we was always working. He was working because he had his own hair care line. So there was no time for me to be with my dad. I'm going to the studio. Nah, you finna get in here and goddamn fill these bottles and these jars up, my boy. We finna get this money. We finna get on the road. We finna travel. I'm gonna show you what survival looks like. I'm gonna show you how to survive. And so it was interesting, because by the time I was 12, I was in a group. I was in a group at 10. But by the time I was 12, I was in a group called Nonviolators. And my mother, she had an accident on the job, which ended up, she ended up having to sue the company. She got a decent payout settlement. And I remember her buying a van, because she used to go back and forth to Anniston, Alabama, to take the people from the hood to go play bingo. And after a while, she got tired of doing that, because it was taking her away from home too much. And she dedicated that van to my group so we could travel. So she was there and saw more of that aspect of me being molded into this entertainer. Not saying my dad didn't see it, but he didn't see it as much. We'd be on the road, he'd be like, "So you taking the rap thing serious?" Like, "Well, why don't I ever see you writing?" Like, "Because I like to be in my own space." He said, "Well, You know, one thing that's going to make you better is you're going to have to challenge yourself to be able to do that when you're not in your comfortable space. He said, because right now you're not being productive in the field you're trying to go in. And I see that you're adamant about it, but you're not taking this time to properly hone your craft because you're not comfortable in the setting. Learn to get comfortable in uncomfortable settings. And when he started stressing that to me, he brought me a composition book. I never forget it. You know, the white, the black and white joint on the front. And I started writing. So now that also opened another lane in our relationship because now I'm able to get that. Yeah, now that was that's tough. Or I don't know. I don't know if, I don't think, I don't get it. I don't get it. I help me understand. I don't know what that means. That don't make sense, you know? And so that's when it became real. It was like, okay, this boy, I want to rap.
Yeah,
Go for what you know. Do your thing.
I love to hear that, man, because although he didn't see it, he could still provide you some type of guidance and advice that you can use in your journey, man. So I love that,
Yep.
although he didn't, see it, he still tapped in with you and was able to kind of just guide you. And I think that's what a father is there for, man. So I'm glad you had your mom who supported you along the journey, but then also your father too. That's dope. And I want to fast forward to, let's say, 2006. You had it's going down, come out. I know you see it. That was kind of that era. Now, like I said in the beginning, that was special for me because I graduated high school in 06. I wonder for you, like, what was that era like for you, just being, all the hard work you put in as a kid, being in groups and, doing different things, just getting to that point where, like, your music is just taking over the entire world. People doing dances. Like, what was that like for you?
It was interesting because at that point, now I'm a father. You know, it was some moments, man. I was in some challenging situations. You know, my brother had the weed, pounds and pounds and pounds, bales of weed. So, you know, here I am. We winning talent shows. I'm winning every open mic I'm going to, and it's a few that I didn't win, and I felt like, damn, that was just God showing me how the world works sometimes, and it helped me understand economics as well because I would be doing these open mics, and although the crowd was lit for me, right? These open mics, so the circuit really would be based on crowd participation and crowd involvement. And a lot of times, if it's a crew over there and it's 25 people in their crew, even though you're snapping or you're doing your thing on this particular showcase, they can't give you that much love because they're with somebody they're trying to win. They're trying to help win. And I just remember a few times when I was like, damn, man, how the fuck I didn't, why didn't I win? So everybody was up. They're like, yeah, but them cats right now, they be coming 40 deep and they come every week. They had to win. So then that made me start realizing I need to move around with people to support me. And the best way to get people to support me, I had to support people. So that's why I was going to all the different open mics, things like that. And even when I had this going down, it hadn't popped yet. But because I knew it was going to be a hit, I wasn't even performing it in some of those places because I didn't want people to think that. You know, I didn't want people to hate on me like, damn, what? He feeling he on. Like, so I would just do other songs. Like I had this song called Thousand Ones. And I had this one called Nail Another. So I was doing them songs while I got this going down. And people didn't even know I had the hit. So I started building that following. So I was supporting people so they'd support me. Then one day the cat was out the bag. Boom. Greg Street got a hold to the record. You know what I'm saying? I think Nitty sent it to Greg Street and my boy Jermaine, call him Fresh. Fresh set me up with Carl Moe. Carl Moe set me up with Block. Of course, now it's me, Chino, Block. Now we got Diddy involved. So things began to look up, started to change. Money was coming in, it started happening. And the craziest thing, bro, is when somebody just they know you, right? Then one day they realize like, Boy, you finna be rich. Boy, you finna be that. But and so people be looking at you, and you out and about just kicking, and you run to people from school. They're like, "Bro, when you start rapping?" I've been rapping since I was 10. Why I ain't never know? Because a part of being with my father, he's a salesman, right? And he never wanted to put his name on a product that he didn't fully believe in just yet. So he had certain products that he'd been working on for years, but they never had come out yet. So he wasn't promoting them. So when I didn't feel comfortable about something, I wouldn't promote it. I wouldn't, oh, like, I'm on.
Really
Like,
got on.
damn, I'm on.
Yeah. Oh, that's what's up,
I'm
man.
in circles. I'm hanging out with, I'm here hanging out with Paris Hilton. I'm looking at Paris Hilton and she's right there with me. I'm like, damn, I'm looking over here. I'm like, yo, that's LL Cool J. Like, damn, I am in Kamora Lee Simmons' house. That beautiful. Good God. You know what I'm saying? That was that real we made it moment. So that experience me was everything because I had worked so hard, I had lost so much, I had sacrificed so much to try to pursue my dreams. So when it actually happened, man, I was so humbled. I was so just like thankful. I couldn't thank God enough. It was that days that everybody was around like, "You that? Are you the man?" I'm like, "Yeah, but I don't even feel like that. I'm just happy to be here, and I'm happy to be living out my dreams."
You done been through so much to get there. It's like when you get there, you like, man, like I'm just grateful. You know what I'm saying? So I feel that wholeheartedly, man. And like I said, that was a very special time for me in that era. But even now, man, like almost 20 years later, like how does it feel for you for those songs to still be used on TikTok videos and just circulating around the world? People still doing the dances. Like that's a longevity that a lot of people can't say that they have in so in terms of that impact. So like almost 20 years later, how does that feel?
It feels like everything that I wanted it and wanted it to be, imagined it to be, dreamed it to be, longed for it to be, worked hard for it to be. So I'm not in a, damn, I can't believe it. You know, you say, I can't believe this when it's just like, it just happened. You just got lucky and it happened like, damn, what? You know, just think about it. It's almost like imagine becoming a meme one day, right? You just say you just chilling. You just, like right now, we're doing the interview. I say something in the interview, it don't sound that outstanding to me or that prolific or profound, but when people see that clip, now they cut that one part of the clip, and now people using something that I may say, that is a damn, I didn't know it was gonna happen moment. You know what I'm saying? But now when we're saying, hey, we need to make something that people are gonna use and say, and it happens, then you're like, job well done. Properly ex task properly executed, you know. So when I see that my music, just like right now, on songs like "Buy You a Drink," I remember having the opportunity to do "Buy You a Drink," and I did it without a doubt. They came and was like, "It's cool, but it ain't." I'm like, "Man, I'm snapping. You need a metaphor? I'm silly." They're like, "Yeah, but it's a record for women, not like for this. Buy you a drink. Nobody's trying to think too hard. We talk about getting drunk." They like talk that shit, talk like jock. Give me that. I was like, "Won't you meet me at the bar? Respect, big pimping, right?" Something in my mind said, "Hey, do not let this record get away because of your ego. You feel like you young jock. You're established now. You're rich. You sitting on 10 million. Can't nobody tell you go rewrite your verse." But I said to myself, in this case, I'm gonna let somebody tell me to rewrite my verse and I'm gonna go do it. And I did it, right? So that's what it looks like when you say job well done, task properly executed. So now to go back to what you said. Last year, boom, Bounty. Quicker Picker Upper, Bounty. Now you may hear a commercial where it starts off, "I'm gonna buy you a drink." Then oh my God, you wasted a drink. Bounty, get Bounty, the new pick, quicker picker up. That's a commercial. That's a check. Boom. Last night, I opened my email. My attorney, I'm like, oh, what's this? Boom. the new Grand Theft Auto. It's called America. What do they want to do? They want to license these same songs. So when you doing things the right way, and you stand on business, like we like to use that phrase today, you stand on that business stand up for you. And that's what it feels like. So to sit back and like, another check, another check, another check. This is what you sacrifice for. This is what you work so hard for. And this is the reason why I don't understand why a lot of cats who have worked so hard to become who they are and still go out and do dumb, frivolous things that take it all away.
But I think that just goes back to like upbringing, right? We talked about discipline from the jump. That was established when you was younger. So when you got into a space of when it happened for you, you had that discipline to know, like, you know, you're going to do it the right way. You think that's what it was?
You see what I'm doing? I'm telling you, you feel me.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Because that is, I mean, it's important. And you know what? I have to attribute that to that upbringing. I have to, because I be around a lot of cats. And I give a perfect example. Not to put too much out there, but to put it out there in a very respectful and candid way. I could be around certain entertainers or people, and everybody could be smoking weed, and they'll pass the blunt right past me. They'll be like, yeah, Jock, you don't smoke weed. And I'd be like, oh, but I do. Probably more than y'all. But there's a level of discipline and reservation within me that says, why do I gotta promote what I do? It ain't making me no money. Now, in today's society, you know, they got cannabis. I mean, you know, you got these dispensaries, you got lines of, you know, people got their own lines now. You know, yeah, Wiz Khalifa got a, Mike Tyson got, so now it's more of a cooler thing to do. And even then, even that, knowing because I'm a father and I have kids, that's one income that I've just chose to say I'm cool on.
Right. And to that point, man, like, you know, just speaking on, you know, fatherhood and your journey so far, you mentioned when 2006 came around, you were father at the time. Was that hard to balance all of that fame or all of the fame, the new fame, while also trying to be a dad? What was that juggle like?
It really wasn't that hard because my kids were young. When I came out, I only had my oldest son, Imani, my oldest daughter, Corey, and my wife at the time. She was pregnant with my second son. So by the time we dropped, Mirror was born in January. It's going down, it was bubbling. You know what I'm saying? So they were kids. It was nothing. I didn't have to take them places that I didn't want them at. So it wasn't hard. The hardest part was trying to balance a thriving career, a fresh thriving career, and a fresh journey of marriage and fatherhood and parenthood, you know what I'm saying? And I think, you know, that was kind of like, okay, but I'm coming, and I'm coming home with that bag. I'm coming home to a home that was purchased with that bag. And, you know, so it was kind of like, shit, this ain't no different if I was in the military or the president of the United States. We think of the president as a wholesome person at all times, right? They got family, and they take the family photo ops, and that's what it is. How much time do you think a president spent with his children?
Not much.
See what I'm saying? So those were the things that thought process helped me not feel like a bad parent. That thought process. Because if I didn't have that thought process, I'd be like, man, I ain't spending enough time with my kids.
No, I feel that, man. And like, even to this day, like right now, eight children, right? You got eight kids?
Nine.
Nine kids, I think four baby mothers.
Five.
Nine kids, five baby moms, right? Like, how do you balance all the personalities and the nuances between co-parenting with nine kids and five baby mothers? I'm pretty sure there's some hurdles that you got to get over. How do you balance it all?
For the most part, all the mothers are respectful to one another. They're all respectful to me. They're all respectful to my wife, Kendra. Kendra's respectful to all of them. Let's get that straight. Then there's tears to my situation in parenthood and fatherhood because my oldest son is 24 years old. So it's so interesting when I hear women like, "Oh, I couldn't be with a man with all them kids. Why can't you? He can afford all his kids. He's raised and properly reared all of his kids. Ain't no drama from the baby mamas. I mean, you watch a show like Love and Hip Hop, you think, oh, this happening all the time. If it was happening all the time, we'd be all over the blog sites all the time. It's not like that. I'm not sitting here with nine rugrats running low. He's like, God damn, oof, oof. You go to his house, this kid is there. It's not that, my oldest 24. My daughter right under him, she's 21, junior college. You know what I'm saying? My son under her, he's about to be a freshman in college. He's graduating with a degree, dual enrollment program. He's going to West Point. You know what I'm saying? He's going to West Point with a full ride. I don't got to spend nothing. He's Mr. Best Academy. He's captain of his football team. So, all those kids are older than my daughter under him, Chase. She's going to high school, academically inclined. So all the kids are on they on their boom, boom, boom. But then after that crew right there, they high school now, right? All the elementary kids, you ready for this?
Yeah.
They are about to be going to middle school here shortly. That's two sets of twins. So with them, it's good. They're in the phase where, while raising them, I get to teach them more because I've learned more. You know what I'm saying? I think I'm better at being a father now because I've fathered for 2.5 decades now. Also, with that being said, this is probably the first time I've said it on a interview or a podcast, but I'm a grandfather. I'm a grandfather, 44 years old. So, it ain't it's life. It's still. But I ain't dealing with certain stuff I'm not dealing with. But I do have my growing pains and moments we do as a family because, like my son, yeah, Dad, I'm committed. Oh, whoa, how you committed? What you mean? You got Stanford over here looking. You can go, all these HBCUs. Nah. I want to go to West Point because they also offer me a full ride. I can play basketball, I can play football. But also, I'm academically inclined as well. So, I'm going to go be an engineer. I'm going to go play football. Got a backup plan for engineering. And also, when I come out of there, I'll be a second lieutenant or something like that. I'll be an officer. I'll be making whoop de whoop. Well, so I was like, okay. Well, I was about to be upset. Hey, man, you ain't going to do that just yet. We need to figure this out. Shit. He gave me the rundown so good. I was like, full ride. They ride out, you know what I mean? So,
Where do you think that comes from? Like, you being an entertainment rapper, all those things, and he's like, that's his path. Like, where do you think that came from in terms of him just wanting to take that direction? And have any of your kids or any of your kids wanting to be in entertainment, music, or any of those things?
my oldest son, money. He could sing. His mother could sing. So he's kind of trying to find this balance between singing and rapping. He does them both well. Just trying to find himself, the image, you know, the whole delivery of who he is. But everybody else, although I was a rapper, they still see a businessman. You know, I don't really talk on the phone a lot. So when I'm on the phone, it's business, and it's not just music business. Might not even just be entertainment business. It's business. So they sit back watching, and I'm telling them, hey, this is the way you should go. They're following them directions.
Yeah, no, that's what's up. I love to hear that, man, because it just there's so many different lanes that we can go into as people. So being that they've saw you operate not only in entertainment but as a businessman, that gives them a great just something to look up to and just different routes that they can go in terms of going into adulthood and careers. And you bring up your son Imani, which has been well documented where you guys have had your hurdles and things that you guys have been through. How's that relationship now?
It's great. I think it's kind of didn't get bad to his last year of high school, or not high school, after high school. Once he started feeling himself, I'm a man, you know, I got him a car. He started feeling like, oh, I'm this guy. But also he's, you know, st still in the hood. Trying to get him come live with me. He wants to stay in the hood. No problem. That's what he knows more of, you know, more friends and family in that setting. And it just was like he was trying to go down that path. I'm like, nah, you're tripping. You gotta focus, man. That ain't. I'm like, it ain't too many people coming out the hood in the best shape. Like, the average person coming out. They're not focused on true financial stability. They're focused on financial spendability.
Difference.
If I can make that a word, because cash is focused on, so how much can I spend? How much can I borrow? And of course, you gotta be thinking how much you could make, but they're not looking at how to stabilize that financial picture. A lot of people, not everybody out of the hood. I'm just saying. And the hood ain't just black either. I mean, just the hood, period. You know what I mean?
I got you. And with that relationship with your oldest son, I mean, it got to a point where you guys, pretty much came to blows or whatever. As a father, I know that has to be tough because you got so much love for this kid that you're raising. Like, how did you move past those tough moments where y'all had those like very intense just arguments and just trying to get him to understand where he was coming from and him trying to do the same? How'd you, kind of move past those moments?
You know what's interesting, man? The community. The community. The culture. Social media. Because people were able to hear. It was like a public court appearance. And the public was there. Wild in a sense. And when I say this trial, these trials and tribulations, they was watching it. And it was so easy for people to tap in and say, hey man, what you acting like you ain't had no father. You act like your dad ain't been there for you. You know, you got family, you know, when your whole family come down on you and be like, hey, you can't do that. That ain't you, no, that ain't no. That man loved you, has loved you, loved on you for your whole life. I've been there every step of the way. I ain't miss a lot of birthday parties. I ain't miss a lot. I was at a lot of football games. He wanted to do plays too. I was at the plays, you know. I make sure that I was involved in his life. I think that journey was so like relatable to so many people. People was tapping in. Mothers was tapping in with him. Fathers was tapping in with him. And I think after a while, he started being like, Okay. Let me think about what I'm doing. Because why am I having an issue with my dad? And I think, some things may have been said. Like one day he said, why everybody else mama got a nice house and my mama don't have one? I said, well, your mama had a nice house. I got your mama a nice house. Not saying she don't have a nice house now, but he's saying like to that level, like I'm saying also, son, these other women that I've conceived children with, some of them are just good at what they do. You got a college graduate who can make 6 to 7 figures. I can't, you can't shortchange her ability to make money. You can't. So they got their money plus whatever child support I'm giving them. You know what I'm saying? So it would be little things like that where I think he felt like, maybe I didn't fully stand by his mother. But of course, by the time we were walking away from each other, he was a kid. I didn't want to walk away. I read texts a lot. People all say, oh, you create all these broken homes. I said, well, the thing about this is I didn't create a broken home and start my children's life. And it wasn't me who necessarily created the broken home. Because sometimes people want to be able to do what they want to do when they want to do it, how they want to do it, for whatever reason why they want to do it. So let's just say, and I'm not going to say who, but let's just say you got a woman and a man, and the man is trying his best to keep his unit together. And the woman like, boy, you got a bag, and I can't really get the bag out of you this way. But if I break up with you and take your ass to court, the judge is gonna make you give me a certain amount of money. I'm just saying, just think about that for a second. Just if you just step back and think about it, like, well, if we together, I can get some things, I can ask you for some things, but I might not be able to guarantee that, or it might not be guaranteed that because we dating, you're gonna get $5,000 because we dating. But if we break up, we get child support and $5,000 a month. That's guaranteed. I'm gonna get the money, and I can do what I want to do with the money. Not just, oh, you bought me some, or you gave me allowance or some money. And, okay, we out to eat, we going around doing stuff. But somebody want that money themselves. So I know I'm going off on a tangent, but we talking about fatherhood, and these are some of the things that don't get said much. And the only reason I went off on that tangent down this vein is because I see people say things, oh, you created these broken homes. I'm like, yo, well, so with me and my first son's mother, I remember us having an argument, and it went, she got physical, her and her cousin jumped me. I never forget that, her and Kim. And I had to put their ass in the closet because they was trying to kill my ass, right? And she said, I don't want anything to do with you. I hate you. I want you out of my life. I'm like, you don't mean that, do you? Like, why are we breaking up right now? I'm not even in the wrong. It's proven that I'm not in the wrong, right? And I believe if I was in the wrong, we would have stayed together. Because then at that point, I would have been trying to make it right, for why I screwed up. But because I wasn't wrong and it got to that extreme and I wasn't wrong, I didn't do what you accused me of doing. And you told me you hate me and you don't want me in your life. That put me in a position where I said, well, there's no future here because here I am. I ain't even do nothing wrong and I get treated like this. So I hate to see what happened if I do something wrong. And for that reason, I was out. And she didn't let up. She stood on business. So people like to say, you creating these broken homes. Sometimes the man don't want to leave. Sometimes the man don't want it to be over with. Sometimes the man does not want to be extracted from what he considers his home. He want to keep his unit together. And sometimes it's women who are just, and I'm not saying women are bad people. I'm just saying sometimes women have the power to put an end to things. Because a man can say, I don't want to be with you no more, right? And a woman can sway her way back in. All she gotta do is be soft and gentle and love on him. Cook him some food, rub his head, rub his feet when he's tired. All right, baby. Man, I'm sorry. Because it's gonna be hard to get a new woman to come right in and grant him that type of affection and attention right off. And sometimes we don't like, it's just like a man, you don't want to skip a meal, do you? So you also don't want to skip good treatment. So I don't want to have to meet a bunch of people and try to find who gonna give me that treatment, then build that relationship up again and up. That's why a lot of people stay in relationships because they don't want to go without. Now, you reverse that and let a woman say she's done. You can come back and try to be protective. You can come back and try to shower her with gifts. You can come back and try to love on her and all that. When a woman stand on that business, they're gonna stand on that business a little different. So a lot of times the broken home does not just it's not just in part because of the father.
No, I totally hear what you're saying, man. You don't got to apologize for just running on a tangent because, like you said, those things don't get said a lot, and but they need to be said. They need to be talked about, and that's what our platform is all about. And I'm curious, like, from that experience to now being remarried, what things have you learned from your past experiences that are making you a better man and father today?
Well, you ever fought with a friend, close friend? You ever had a fight with a close friend, somebody you love and care about? And you'd be like, man, things will never be the same after this. Then you look up two days later, maybe 3 days later, y'all over that shit. And because you're over and you're so glad that you're back in the space, you actually compartmentalize that increment on your timeline, and you take it, compartmentalize, and put that over here with shit I don't want to remember, shit I don't want to ever happen again. You see what I'm saying? It won't ever happen again. And I think that is one of the things that I've learned. So, like, if me and my wife get in an argument today, I don't have to have the last word. I know she may say some things that's gonna cut. I can say some things that's gonna cut. But I figure, you know what? If I don't cut you as much, and I'm still standing here loving you. If I don't fight you back, if I don't have to have the last word, and I'm still standing here loving you, that's a part of me priming that person to understand that I truly love them. That's a part of me priming my person to know that I'm still here. It's through the thick and thin, for better or worse. And everybody doesn't understand that because your emotions become law. You know what I'm saying? Right now, if I slap you, bah, and you mad enough to hit me back, something tells you that the law says you hit me, I can hit you back. So that emotion becomes a law. So if I say something that rubs you the wrong way, your logical goes out the window. And your emotional steps up and takes the forefront, takes the wheel. And a lot of times your emotional space will make you crash out. So in my marriage, I learned to not be as emotional and take that energy and put that, I want to make sure that is going over to the other side, to the logical side. And that means that I'm gonna sit here and think about it like,
Has there been any therapy involved in that getting to know yourself and just being able to over the years?
you know what? I will say this, my pastor and I, man, we've had some therapy sessions, and our first therapy session was a 11-hour session. He called me, he said, man, you say you need to talk to me, and I need to know what's going on because you're sounding like something wrong. He said, and my spirit is you, something in my spirit awakened, and it was the tone. And he said, we need to tap in, and, come to the golf course. Let's sit down and talk. We got to talking, and I told him I had done something, and I didn't know how it was going to change the trajectory of my future, the trajectory of the relationship with my then fiance. And I was just like, I was low, one of those low moments again. And we talked and we talked and we talked to me for hours. Of course, we was in the process of handling business during that time, moving around those things. But I was with my pastor for 11 hours. I don't think I ever spent that much time with no pastor, no person who's there to help me with any type of therapy. No, ever. Only a best friend, a brother or father or mother. You know what I'm saying? Or a sister. But I'm just saying, like, nobody outside of family that I've sat down to talk to about a problem or issue that I need to help with. And so those sessions, man, of course they're not 11 hours. That was just that day. We spent the whole day really like trying to break this thing down and figure it out. So that therapy should be a part of your monthly routine.
Yeah, no, I
Because,
agree.
you know, when your phone bill due, when your phone bill come out, you get an assessment of all the calls made going in or going out or coming in. You get an assessment of how many text messages or emails, how many things you purchased over your phone. You know what I'm saying? You know, when you pay your mortgage, you get an assessment of, you know, I don't know what happened.
Yeah, it just dropped off.
Okay. So I think therapy is, it should be implemented on a monthly basis. Put some money for that because we'll spend the things that we think are therapeutic. You know, we'll go to the club, we'll go to the cigar bar. You know, we may go play golf, we may go play some ball. You know what I'm saying? You might just want to get out on the town and bar hop. And that costs far more than what it would cost for therapy. I think the reason I say therapy once a month because your life is structured by numbers. Everything we do is based on numbers, you know, believe it or not. You know, let's just really think about it. Like, when we agreed to do this call, it was going to be at a certain time, on a certain date, for a certain length of time, right? For a certain number of people to view it. It's all numbers. At the end of the month, when you pay your light bill, gas bill, phone bill, mortgage, car note, insurance, medical, whatever, there's an assessment that comes every month and that tells you what you spent, right? So why don't we have a personalized assessment of our life for the past 30 days? How many good days did you have this month? Did you have more good days than you had bad days this month? That's a question. That's a question that the average person don't ask themselves. Did you have more moments where you told the truth opposed to you lying this month? Did you have more days where you believed in yourself than days you didn't believe in yourself? You need a monthly assessment. And I hate to sound like a pastor, but that's the truth. And I never said this ever in my life. This is the first time I ever said that. And you brought that out of me, brother. And I appreciate that because now I get to talk about this more. Remember how we talked about that mean thing, girl? How something might just come about and you don't even realize. But that's one of those things that mess around and go viral because people will sit back and say, damn, you're right. And they want to share that. And the next person said, damn, you're right. I want to seem like I this was good knowledge to share. Share. Pass on. You realize that one little moment in time, those few seconds of what I said, based on numbers, it was a few seconds, but I said something at the right time, and it passes along by way of numbers, the powers of numbers. And now people are saying, yeah, I do believe that a personal assessment by way of therapy should be done every 30 days.
No, that's facts, man. That's definitely a gem, and I agree with you wholeheartedly, man. Like I saw this quote the other day, and it said, being a father helps you fight back. For you, like going through those rough moments, have there ever been any times where you wanted to like give up, or you were just going through a really just like low moment where like your kids kept you going and just like, you know, made it to the point that they helped you get through those tough times?
Hell yeah. Because adults don't help you get through it all the time. You know why? Because adult could look at you into something wrong. They could hear what you're talking about on the phone. Everybody ain't, right now, you could be sitting there and somebody know it's a possibility of eviction. Or it's a possibility of a default. It's a possibility of being bankrupt. Because as adults, we've seen and learned and heard a lot, done a lot. So you could look at somebody and be like, "Nah, bro, you look like you ain't, why you ain't want to do that? Why?" And then next thing you know, they're like, "Oh, yeah." And what we feel like is a part of therapy is not necessarily therapy every time you talk to somebody, because now you're thinking, is this person gonna go back and tell my business? Is this person gonna think of me differently? Am I no longer this person's go-to because I'm not the person they thought I was? And that's one thing. But when you get around them kids, and them kids may or may not pick up on what you're going through, but guess what they do? They let you know that they feel everything gonna be all right because they happy as hell to see you. They want to tell you about their day. They want to tell you something funny that they just did right before you out the door. They want to ask you some questions. And at that moment, you tell yourself, man, well, I may feel like I ain't doing something right because I'm caught, I done found myself in a situation or a bind or a chokehold. If these kids run around here happy while all this turmoil is really what's really, really going on, and if these kids that happy, I'm doing something right. And I'm not just speaking of me in general in this place. I've seen it happen with people. Like, damn, bro, going through it. But man, his daughter just said the cutest shit, man. And it just, he got all his woes. He forgot about all his lows at that moment. You know what I'm saying? And so that's, yes, kids, my kids have definitely helped me in some bad
No,
times.
I love to hear that, man. And just speaking about, like, you know, when you raise men, you raise young women, like, what has been your different approach or your approach to raising your girls versus raising your boys? Do you approach those things differently?
Well, girls, you have to handle them with a different care. You know, when you talk with girls, you try not to be as explicit or as transparent. Because women are very clever anyway. That's why they're able to be sneakier than us. That's why they mature faster than us. They're clever. Sometimes, if you could just be clever enough to get their attention and they pick up on what you're saying, that's a plus. That's a win. You feel what I'm saying? With the boys, you almost can't be. They ain't got time to be clever. It's too many more distractions. Oh, yeah, I heard you. You know, you asked about, you heard what I said? Yeah, what I say? Can you preach this up? You didn't hear me. Distractions. So with the boys, you got to be straight up. You got to be the distraction. You see what I'm saying? You have to be the distraction that distracts them from all the other BS that's going on around them, all the BS that's looming. You have to be the distraction and make sure they understand where the hell you coming from. Because that it will go in one ear, out the other.
I totally feel that, man. Like us is, I remember myself as a young boy going to school, man, all these things going on, and I didn't have that father figure around, but I can look now and see how that type of approach would have helped me. Like somebody just distracting me from all the other distractions. I like that, man. And I feel like you've dropped so many gems today, man. And it's been very therapeutic for me to learn more about you as a man and as a father. And one thing that we do here at Dear Fathers, you know, we do like a hypothetical letter. So if you could write a hypothetical letter to your dad, starting with Dear Father, what would you say?
I would say, dear father, I would tell him I really appreciate every sacrifice ever made. I would tell him I appreciate every challenge that he ever put in front of me. I would tell him thank you for every moral, every parable he ever showed me or pointed out to me. I would tell my father, you know, thank you for showing me how to be a man. Thank you for never turning your back on me. Thank you for always, like, just, man, being there for me. Because it was a lot of homies, a lot of cousins, even brothers who they ain't had that. Thank you for protecting your mental health so that you didn't go astray and you didn't go, you know, down that wrong path so you could be there for myself and my other siblings. That's what I would tell my dad. He's been one of the most genuine people in my life, one of the most solid people in my life, you know? And I mean, man, I'm not crying because of everything my father has done for me. You know, I'm also these tears because it's so many other lost souls out here who didn't have this, who didn't have that. And so my tears are, I'm thankful on one end that I had this from my father. But I also realize in knowing what I have and where I'm at today, you know, when we ask a lot of questions about other friends and people that we see who just didn't turn out right or didn't make it past a certain age or their life in shambles or they behind bars, I hurt for them, man. I hurt for them because at this very moment after doing this interview, I realized why so many of my brothers have been led astray because that foundation wasn't as strong as it could have been or should have been. And for that, you know, I'll take the time to tell my dad, thank you for everything. Because had he not been that person in my life, you know, dog, I wouldn't even be able to sit here and have it.